and welcome to Trans Positive. We are recording Trans Positive on Zoom tonight because we're trying to stay safe and stay home. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Nicolette and I use and them pronouns.
My name is Jean. I use it's she and her pronouns.
So first I wanted to discuss a few news articles that I thought were very pressing to the trans community. The first one is that recently Britain's Equality Minister Liz Truss has announced a major government policy change on trans rights, which will ban transitioning before the age of 18. According to the announcement, the British government will be updating the Gender Recognition Act this summer to make sure that people under the age of 18 will be prevented from making decisions that are, quote, irreversible in the future. So they haven't elaborated much on what this means. You know, do they just mean surgery? Do they mean HRT? Are they even going to ban puberty blockers and the right to present as your identified gender? This has so many harmful implications because so many trans youth already struggle with mental health and even commit suicide because they aren't able to transition. And this is just going to exacerbate the problem. Furthermore, she said another principle being added to the update is the protection of single-sex spaces. So what does that mean? Does that mean the government won't allow trans people to use bathrooms and changing rooms that align with their identified gender? You know, they haven't, she hasn't really answered any questions about the specifics of any of these.
Yeah, I heard about this. It was very disturbing. Do you know what its origin was? I mean, when I think about Britain, I think of a culture that's, it seems like they're a little bit more tolerant over there than the United States. So,
actually, it's when it comes to trans rights, things that I've seen come out of the UK is that it's even more polarized there than it is here. And that, you know, they have a conservative government. Mm-hmm. We're not alone here in the United States in that respect.
My very first transgender internet icon was this British lady, and she documented her entire transition, like, you know, and she used the NHS, the National Health Service in Britain, to do her transition. And this was like about 8 years ago. Yeah. And I was so impressed with her story, and I thought, oh, well, they've got it so great over in Britain, but I guess they don't.
Apparently not. And it looks like it might just be getting worse. I think right now our policies may be a little more lax than Britain's at the moment. The Gender Recognition Act, they're going to be updating it. It was originally created in 2004 as a way to begin protecting trans rights. But I guess now they're going to be cutting back on those rights a little more.
It's so important to allow people to transition as soon as they're able to consent to transition. In some cultures, the age of like awareness, the age of consent is as low as 12 or 13, like when you're old enough to make a decision for yourself. And I think that especially with transition, I mean, the longer that you wait, the more damage it does to your body. So if you are convinced that you are female or male and you're going to live out the rest of your life in the gender identity that you recognize as yourself, then you should be allowed to start on that process, you know, when you're able to consent to make that decision. So,
right. And I think, you know, at the very least, kids should be allowed to take puberty blockers, you know, so that they can delay when they'll be going into puberty, and if they want to decide later whether they want to transition or just stop taking the puberty blockers and go through their regular puberty. I mean, that can do so much to help with their dysphoria and their mental health in general, because going through the puberty that you feel your body is not supposed to have, that you feel you're not supposed to have, it can cause so much dysphoria, and that can't really be undone in a lot of times.
But my takeaway from it was that, yeah, surgical intervention is basically what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no bottom surgery, no top surgery, nothing below the age of 18. And no HRT either. So, but I didn't see anything in there about puberty blockers.
All she said was that they would be protected from making decisions that are irreversible in the future. So, you know, that would most likely mean HRT and surgery, but she refused to answer any questions clarifying what exactly she means by this.
Yeah.
Maybe this would be a good topic for a future show. We could have somebody on.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that.
So, yeah, I guess that about covers that article, and we will try and find out more for a future show.
My takeaway here is very clearly, you know, we're not alone here in the United States with, you know, still fighting a very uphill, this is a very uphill battle. We've come a long way, but trans healthcare is still a hot potato topic. And, you know, we're not home free, and we haven't been. So it's nice to know we're not alone, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty huge issue worldwide right now. So the next one I wanted to get to, this happened in March, apparently, but I just read the article. 6 transgender and non-binary candidates submitted petitions to run for seats in the government body of the Brooklyn Democratic Party, but they were disqualified because they left the gender field blank on their forms. The only gender options they listed were male or female. I think they're making it pretty clear that they're trying to enforce the cis heteronormative binary on the governing body.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so this is, and I saw that article as well, but it's my understanding that this was an internal Democratic Party process for selecting.
Is there any good news, Nicolette?
Oh, I wish. I have one more article, and it's okay. That's not a positive one. Okay, so there was a trans man who gave birth to his child, and he appealed to be listed on the child's birth certificate as the father instead of the mother. He was denied, and the court's reasoning was that basically we don't know whether all trans men object to being called mother when they gave birth to their child, and we don't know how other members of society would feel if they were no longer referred to as mother and father on their child's birth certificate, but rather parent one and parent two. I think that's pretty dumb reasoning. How about we stop trying to cater to cis people and let individuals decide for themselves how they want to be listed on their child's birth certificate? Why is that such a radical concept? I think it was the Court of Appeals, but I'm gonna pull up the article and see.
That's almost laugh that the court's rationale for their decision is laughable.
So I have one piece of news I'd like to share too. So one big piece of news that happened in the last week, there were 2 transgender women who were murdered in Puerto Rico in the last week. They were found in a car that had been burnt out. And the New York Times just released an article on the murders of these 2 transgender women. And I'd just like to share some of it. Police say they have classified the deaths of 2 transgender women who were found badly burned in a car last week a hate crime. It was a week after the bodies of 2 women were found in Puerto Rico, police said, and they arrested 2 men in connection with the killings and have turned them over to the FBI. The men are Juan Carlos Pagan Bonilla and Sean Diaz de Leon, 21 and 19, and they were taken into custody but have not been charged yet. They're classified as a hate crime because they were socializing with the victims, and once they found out they were transgender women, they decided to kill them, Captain Morales said on Thursday. The women, their names were Leila Pelaez, 21, and Serena Angelique Velazquez, 32. And, they lived in New York City. and the remains were found after a person called 911 and reported a burnt car under a bridge. So
I heard that this is just two more of what they're calling a tremendous increase in the number of trans murders in Puerto Rico within the last year.
That's a unfortunate.
Tremendous increase.
My father is from Puerto Rico. He was born there, and I've been to the island 3 times. It's a lovely place. I mean, it's been so traumatized by the hurricane and by the earthquakes and, you know, the flooding. It was, and the United States has always treated Puerto Rico like it's a colony. Like it's, it's like Cuba and Haiti and the other Caribbean islands. It's kind of there to serve the interests of the United States and it's kind of a second class territory. So it's very unfortunate. I'm so sorry for their deaths. I'm going to remember them tonight. Nicola, thank you so much for sharing those stories today.
Okay, and then I had one which really follows right on the tails of the UK piece. The Department of Health and Human Services, in the final rulemaking process to change the interpretation of Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, which is the piece the Obama administration put in place that prohibits discrimination based on gender identity. And sexual orientation. This is the provision that basically moved, for insurance coverage to cover trans health care.
Right. That we all benefited from.
Yes, that we have been benefiting from for the last
six or eight years.
Okay.
6 years, yeah.
And we've spoken about this. We've spoken about this on a number of our shows in the past.
Yeah, we have.
I believe when we interviewed surgeons Toby Meltzer and Zara Lay.
Yeah, and we interviewed Mara Kiesling, and we talked about
that. Yeah, and Mara Kiesling. We've spoken about this numerous times in past shows. This is very thin. It's never been codified in law. It's policy. It's been policy. And this administration, I don't know why they've waited to this particular moment to really push this. I suspect that once again, we're going to be used as a political lightning rod.
We always are.
You know, in the election.
Yes, we totally will be.
But interestingly enough, this is the final rulemaking because the HHS started it, the process and going through the comment periods and all that kind of stuff about a year ago. Mm-hmm. So this has been in the works for about a year. Mm-hmm. And we're approaching right now the end of that process where they're going to actually issue the revised rule coming up here shortly. I don't know exactly the time frame, but it's going to come up here shortly. A little civics lesson from Jean. Once again, a change is made in rules. This is not law. This is the Code of Federal Regulations. Okay? It's administrative law. It's not civil law. So this has all been published in the Federal Register and comment periods have been run and all of that. And so what made the news in the last week under the headline saying, Trump says it's okay to discriminate, with trans healthcare amid the corona crisis, I think is the way the headline read. But this has been in the works for over a year. Rulemaking takes about a year, and this is hearkening back to our conversations with Mara Kiesling. Oh my goodness, in 2016, before the election, I think we did another one with her where we talked about some of this stuff, that it would take years, and it does. It takes a couple, it takes a good year or so to make a change like this. Yeah, we're here now. We're here now, and it's coming. So here's one last thing. This is just my take on this. This is my interpretation. Most likely what will happen. We hope to, now, I seriously doubt that it, within the state of Oregon, they're going to change anything. This, because the state has embraced this. So, you know, locally, maybe some private plans would, you know, go back to a trans exclusionary posture. But I seriously doubt that it's, I really seriously doubt that it's going to have any major effect in Oregon, and probably in Washington either. Probably California. West Coast is probably not going to feel too much difference in this. But really what hit the headlines was a memo with the Department of Justice, not Health and Human Services. And what the Department of Justice memo is about is, okay, we are no longer going to these cases. So with Attorney General Barr, this Department of Justice is not going to, if anything, they may even, you know, join in defending people who and companies or doctors or hospitals or whatever that do discriminate. That's what the memo that hit the headlines was about. It was Department of Justice. So that's what I know about it. This administration is not going to go down easy. They're gonna take, but
very true.
You know, once they're gone, but for God's sakes, let's get them out of there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Nicolette. All right. Good evening. You are listening to Transpositive on KBOO Community Radio. We are recording over Zoom because the radio station is closed, and we're doing everything at home because we want to stay home and keep ourselves safe and keep the people we care and love about safe. All of our trans and non-binary brothers and sisters, we want to keep them all safe by staying home. So tonight we're talking with, tonight we are going to be talking about art and language and identity. And I'd like to introduce Jean to introduce our guest tonight.
Yeah, so good evening, Jean. Once again, she, her pronouns. And every year since we've been doing Transpositive, about this time of year, in the spring, usually April or May, we feature trans artists and trans representations in the arts. And tonight we're honored to have with us as our guest, Kara K. Morgan. Kara has joined us in the past, 2 or 3 years ago she came on. Kara is
an amazing writer.
She is a poet, an author, and a spoken word artist. And Kara is going to, first of all, I'd like to welcome Kara. Kara?
Hello, everyone. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Kara's got several pieces that she, of spoken word, that she wants to read for us. And we'll discuss them with her upon her, you know, completion of each piece. And with that, Kara, welcome. So glad to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So what do you got for us, Kara?
Should I start? Well,
can you tell us about, you know, kind of what your objectives are, what are these pieces about, and you know, so what are you doing with your art here?
I've written a lot about what it means to be a transsexual in a culture that essentially doesn't recognize that you exist, what the possibilities and perception are, and what the possibilities and how we perceive ourselves are. and what the limitations in how we perceive ourselves are. And so these are little essays, really. And you may find part of it politically incorrect, but I recommend listening through to the end because they do come around and make sense of themselves eventually.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. The first piece is called A Word for the Misbegotten. A new acquaintance came over last evening. She's a longtime male to female type human. I have referred to myself as a transsexual pterodactyl. My train started to jump off the male rails in 1990. Her changes started around the same time, so I wanted to hear from her perspective. I don't meet many old timers. We got on the subject of the word transgender and how much we both disliked it. My loathing for the word transgender stems from the fact that it does not mean anything, precisely because it means too many things at once. It is used to describe someone like me who has completely hormonally and surgically transitioned. It is also used to describe a decidedly male-appearing person who stretches a bra across a hairy chest, has pink panties hidden under a beer belly, puts on a purple wig, and marches in a pride parade in platform heels. It is a lead pipe cinch that the press will photograph this person as the face of transgender. Now, I'm not saying that this public display of bad taste should be regulated. I just don't want to be lumped in with this person. And the misbegotten word transgender does exactly that. I went on to tell my new friend that I was not particularly happy with the word transsexual either, but as a placeholder, it did not fill me with the same loathing that the word transgender does. She asked me why I was not happy with the word transsexual. I told her that the problem is that it does not clearly map onto anything in the world. She asked me what I meant. I said that words like bus or zebra map onto objects in the world well enough, such that it is not controversial when one uses these words. We don't need to know what type of bus or zebra we're talking about. The basic understanding is uncontroversial. But it is very easy to find examples of basic controversy around gender issues. Politician Lee Bright from South Carolina recently told a GOP crowd that you are either a man or a woman, and if you're confused, you've got an issue with mental illness. I told my friend that half the country thinks we're crazy. The mapping, therefore, is unclear and rife with controversy. My friend said that what transsexuals are is not unclear to clinicians in the field. I said that there is no clear science to date. There may be hints in brain imaging, but the public at large could just as easily lump the clinicians in with the crazies. A politician like Mr. Bright would make the claim that any medical services made available to us as transsexuals is coddling the insane, and this is an explicit plank in many GOP party platforms. But the linguistic problem is deeper than that. The problem revolves around what transsexuals are. Linguistics is the handbook of culture, and we are not in the book. This became very real to me one afternoon. I sat bolt upright and saw how directly the hormones and interventions had saved my life. The hormones were a key that fit in me in some profound way. They fit a something in me that had to happen. I felt that this was just had to make me a real something in physical and medical terms. Looking back, it felt as physical as a baby that it had needed a heart valve corrected. My experience was that this was not a mental condition. It was material. I had experienced the materiality of my transsexual condition. I even found myself presenting the fact that I needed to be on a lifetime of medication. However life-saving it was humbling to my ego. I've heard this described as welcome to your wheelchair. But as much as I was struck by this material experience, in the next moment, I became quite clear that I could not tell you what it means. I struggled to find words for this. All I came up with was this. I can tell you what I've done. I can tell you how it feels. I cannot tell you what it means. This is what I have termed the linguistic void. The thing which is so frustrating to try and communicate is this materiality. My friend asked me why the linguistics seemed so important. She said, why worry about the linguistics? Aren't you just a woman now? I said that it was not that simple for me. I told her that I present myself more or less as a stereotypical woman. I enjoy being treated as a woman. I'm accepted in the world as a woman by and large, and my capacity to experience being a woman continues to grow. And I love everything about this. However, there is a materiality and a texture to being whatever it is that I am that stems from being a transsexual. Simply saying that I am a woman and just calling it good misses out on my texture. It glosses over my materiality. And my materiality itself has something to contribute. It may sound like I want my materiality to be seen by those around me. In an open-minded world, I would be more willing for this to be true. The drawback here is that most people view gender misfits as mental cases. The available dictionary definitions make this clear. They state that a transsexual is an individual who identifies or emotionally feels like they belong to the opposite sex. This is clearly left in the realm of mental and emotional. These dictionary definitions that portray my materiality as a mental condition are at best annoying and at worst deadly. The annoying aspect is that I get tired of being cast as a crazy person. I would rather not have to live in a society that denies that I exist. I have become tough enough to withstand this, but it doesn't mean I have to like it. The more dangerous side of being viewed as a mental patient is that this is easily translated into a moral failing by the Lee Brights of the world. He has publicly stated that people with a different idea of gender should be rounded up and put in camps. What Lee Bright means is that people who have a different idea from his God's idea of gender should be interred. It's a clear lesson from history that feeding people in concentration camps gets expensive and is likely to become an afterthought. I don't have a conclusion to this train of thought. It is a discussion that circles around words and meanings which are not yet. I hope that someday biological science contributes to a better understanding of my materiality. I'm a woman, but I have come to be a woman from a right angle. In pool, it's called a bank shot. Perhaps I will simply describe myself as an orthogonal woman. Maybe the term will catch on.
KBOO Community Radio, and this is Transpositive. My name is Emma, and I'm here tonight with Jean and Kara. We're talking about the arts and gender identity and transition. And Kara is a great writer. And Jean, can you introduce Kara and her next piece?
Yes, well, once again, we're honored to have Kara K. Morgan with us tonight. She is a poet, an author, and spoken word artist of trans experience. And she's agreed to share with several of her pieces. This last one, I think, basically it gets to the linguistic void of how we are struggling in our culture at large, our society at large, and then also even within our own community. In how we, I mean, the evolution of language, just in the time, you know, my life experience is huge within the LGBT overarching, you know, community, and certainly within the trans community, as to what language we use to describe ourselves, and what effect that has, and what effect it doesn't have, and how we still haven't really come around to find anything that's really fully satisfactory for any of us as individuals, per se. And it's a frustrating place to be.
So how about your next piece, Kara?
Yeah. Tell us about your next piece.
The next piece is one of Jean's favorites, and one of mine. It deals with how people must see us. And you'll see what I'm talking about. This is called Rubens' Vase. for 25 years, estrogen has acted upon my being. And as miraculous as estrogen has been, it could not undo all the effects that testosterone had inflicted upon my body. I would look in the mirror and my stomach would be sourly twisted. I kept seeing a square German face looking back at me. And worse yet, it was a male face. The hormones were not enough, and no amount of positive affirmations were of any help whatsoever. I was learning about the human cognitive machinery. I had encountered Rubin's vase. Now, in 1915, Edgar Rubin did pioneering work in cognitive science. He created a type of drawing that can either be interpreted as two silhouettes facing each other or a vase. The faces are done in one color, and the space in between is done in a contrasting color. The drawing revealed basic aspects of our cognitive machinery. When you look at the drawing, you will see either a pair of faces or a vase. You cannot see both at the same time, and you must see one or the other. And the machinery that determines how you see the drawing operates below the level of reason. It is automatic and not open to introspection. You do not decide which way you will see the drawing. It just happens. This type of drawing is called a Rubin's vase. The cognitive effect demonstrated by Rubin's vase is generally called perceptual closure. We encounter massive perceptual input to our senses all day long. We have evolved to automatically distill cars, trees, and houses out of the bundles of perceptual information presented to us. We perform closure on a bundle of information and it becomes a tree for us. We trim this perception from the background and then we hold it as a tree. Our brains have evolved to perform perceptual shorthand and it is efficient to do this. We save time and energy because we do not have to analyze everyday objects as if we've never seen them before. We can even be presented with an incompletely drawn triangle, for example, and our brain will fill in the missing information. We then have no difficulty seeing or holding the figure as a valid triangle. As Noam Chomsky points out, this is hardwired into our perceptual apparatus, and none of it is open to introspection. Recently, a friend told me that although she has been in the LGBT world for many years, she has only seen two genders. I thought about this in terms of perceptual closure and realized that she was absolutely correct. Like Rubin's face, human cognition will see either male or female. In terms of the human cognitive mechanism, there are no other options. You will see one or the other. This cognitive mechanism has nothing to do with one's experience of oneself. And I am in no way invalidating anybody's lived experience. But the mechanism is absolutely blind to your LGBTQI status. It did not evolve to make these distinctions, and it is unlikely to change anytime soon. It is completely futile to look at it as something that can in any way be modified. To put it bluntly, we are stuck with it. In my own experience, I could not stop seeing a male face looking back at me. 2 years ago, I found a plastic surgeon to make some modifications. I had my upper lip shortened, brow ridges ground, and a rhinoplasty. I had changed enough visual cues to flip the cognition of my face. I don't see a male face anymore, and my stomach does not twist when I look in the mirror. It was not a matter of negotiation. I had to accommodate the cognitive mechanism. This cognitive mechanism is at the heart of much misunderstanding. Gender nonconforming people often get upset when they are not seen for who they are and interpret this as disrespect or bigotry. But the mechanism itself is completely impersonal in its functioning. I was talking to my friend Janie about the toggle aspect of gender cognition. I said that it is difficult to be seen as someone in the middle. Her experience is that if your gender presentation is ambiguous, people simply look harder for deeper cues. She said that in her view, it is impossible to be seen in the middle for any length of time. sooner or later, the mechanism will do its job and toggle. So it would appear that what I have described as an impasse, or it would appear that I have described an impasse, a fundamental opposition of our lived experience against a cognitive mechanism that can only see us as male or female. The impasse is real enough, and the mechanism is unlikely to change. But what we can change is our relationship to the mechanism. This brings us to another aspect of the Rubens-faced figure that I have not talked about. It offers a way through the impasse. Although it is seen as faces or a vase, the drawing is actually an abstract figure that is neither. The point is that our personal perceptual closures are always simplifications. The objects produced by our cognitive shorthand are not final. I would like gender nonconforming people to stop fighting with the mechanism. Taken to its extreme, it puts you in the position of telling other people that they do not see what they see. Besides being a total waste of effort, it is a surefire way to piss people off. And I would like the rest of humanity to become aware of their cognitive shorthand and at least be willing to entertain the idea that our cognition may not be final and maybe take the time to look a little deeper.
Thank you. That was wonderful. You're listening to Transpositive on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are talking with Jean and Kara. And Kara is a poet, a writer, ran the trans women's group here in Portland for a long time, really built it up.
Yes.
So with Northwest Gender Alliance, Friday Night Group. So, and tonight we're just talking about art, writing, identity. That was really interesting, Kara, how like, I mean, you make the argument, which I think we all kind of understand and work with as transgender women in terms of how we are viewed. And we really don't want to be viewed in a way that would make us uncomfortable or disorienting. And it kind of acknowledges the reality that most people are programmed to see one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the piece that I relate to all of it, actually. Because I don't think that there's any argument that the cognitive piece, the brain function piece, is what it is. It's frustrating. I don't like it. I don't like the effect of that on my life, my experience. But cognitive peace happens in milliseconds. I mean, literally milliseconds. Someone sees you and they automatically read cues. And they're going to come to a basic conclusion almost instantaneously of, you know, gendering us. And but that what culturally we can do, hopefully over time, is get people to realize that that first split second assessment isn't always right.
Right.
I mean, that's true of cis folks, trans folks, doesn't matter. There are plenty of cis folks who got misgendered, okay? It's not unique to our experience. And so one of the cool things about those of us who challenge, you know, gender norms and that is that eventually people will begin to realize that you can't just make that split second assessment. There's more to us than how we appear. All of us, doesn't matter whether you're trans, cis, non-conforming, doesn't matter. And that's our challenge, is to keep doing what we're doing because the culture is changing. The awareness is changing. it's getting better.
So Jean, how about if we move on to another piece?
Yes, absolutely. I know Kara's got at least one more for us.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I've got this one's fun. I'll have to edit it slightly for the radio, but it'll work. This one's called Thank Jesus, the Apostles, and the Rechargeable Dildo. I was hit with a wave of depression, regret, and shame about a week after surgery. I was okay during my stay at the clinic, but when I arrived at the tawdry halfway house and began the process of dilation, it got really rough. Looking back, I did not know what had hit me. The surgery did not feel anything like I imagined it would. It was at the wrong angle. It was too close to my rectum. The new passage in my body felt too tight and cone-shaped. All it wanted to do was push the dilator out. Yeah. I felt like I'd been hoodwinked. Whatever I had gotten, it was not what I had imagined. Oh. The worst of it was that the new passage in my body felt like a second asshole. I remember telling myself at the time that I was such an asshole that God gave me a second asshole just so there could be no mistake about it. And that was harsh. I want this to be the last piece that I write on this topic, and I'm going to be blunt. You come to hormones and surgery with a head full of fantasies. This is the only position from which you could have come to this. My fantasies died on the operating table. This was a necessary failure. One wants to be hit on the head by the magic girly wand, and what I actually got was what I came to call my prosthetic life. I had not been prepared for the loss of self-definition that accompanied the abrupt end of being the owner of a penis. As much as I wanted it gone, there were layers upon layers of unconsciously held identity that one absorbs as a child simply by virtue of being born in a male body in this culture. I could not understand the emptiness that I experienced after I came home from surgery. It was like I had suffered a stroke and was having to learn how to use a spoon again. I had no way to frame the experience, and it was dumbfounding. Now I can see that this too was inevitable. I did not have inherent expertise in doing a sex change. For Christ's sakes, it's taken a long time for me to forgive myself for how painstakingly slow and timid I have been. At times, the necessary failure has felt very invalidating. And it is so hard to let people in on the internal vicissitudes of one's untidy process. There is ever so much pressure to look like you know what you're doing. After all, we live in the land of the pat answer. It is difficult to admit that maybe you did not achieve your goal. We are such goal-oriented people. And it feels like a dodge to argue for nuance. Then Jermaine Greer points her bony finger at you and calls you a wannabe and sneers that if you had to have a uterus, you would run for the hills. And how do you defend against this? I can't, because I am a wannabe. And I feel ashamed standing next to other people. In the most personal aspect of a human life, I am patched together from sutures and stitches and pieces of chromic 4-0 cat gut, and I hold my stomach and scream inside. And I want to tell Jermaine that if I could step into a molecular machine and have all the right parts and have them doing what they're supposed to do, that no power on earth would be able to stop me from going in. And it's just so easy to dismiss people. We who have slipped off the edge of the normal. My therapist said that genital reconstruction consigns the individual to a parallel universe. The healing pivot for me was to understand that the necessary failure was not a terrible mistake. I did what I had to do. Understanding came much later. My suture lines slowly fade with time. Life is gradually getting better. My body is smarter than my head at this point. It has come to my attention that the prosthesis between my legs is starting to feel like a vagina. Thank God, Jesus, the apostles, and the invention of the rechargeable dildo. Consider these words to be a kind of interdimensional message in a bottle. May it wash up on a distant shore and reduce somebody's time spent in distress over this bullcrap. God knows it's not worth it. Amen.
You know, before the before the pandemic happened, I had a chance to go to San Francisco this this winter, and I went to the Dildo Museum.
Yeah,
yeah, which is at Good Vibrations over in I can't remember if it's the one over in the Mission. Yeah, I think it's the one in the Mission. And it was so interesting learning about, you know, when they first had dildos, they actually used a little turn thing, kind of like an egg beater. They did.
Like before, an egg beater or something, yeah.
Before they had electricity, they used this egg beater thing. And it was, you know, and then the ones they had in the 50s, oh my goodness. It was like a gigantic iron or even a steam press. It was so huge, you know. And of course, but in the 70s, they just got great. So you came along just in time, Kara.
She's got one more.
Oh, great. Okay, let's.
Here's another another piece written about words and linguistics. It's called The Simple Test of Litmus. I was having a conversation with my good friend Kathleen, and she was my recent teacher in English composition. We were talking about linguistics and how this relates to being a gender misfit, specifically the transsexual kind. She asked me why the linguistics were so important. She said, well, why do you need a label at all? Why does anybody need a label? Our conversation had used up her office hour that day, so I came home and wrote this piece as an answer. I would be fine with a world that did not place such importance on labels, but we're obligated to use labels in daily life, like we're obligated to use a driver's license. I may know how to drive perfectly well, but I still must have a license when I operate a motor vehicle. Having no license is fine until a cop pulls you over. Then you encounter the problems that come with a licensing void. A friend of mine, whose name is Deidre, was in Arkansas when someone felt that she had used the label in error. People in Arkansas take their labels very seriously, and her linguistic error was pointed out to her by a baseball bat across the face. This is the practical side of the troubles that come from finding oneself in the linguistic void. The linguistic void is the place you go after you turn in the passport for the gender into which you were consigned at birth. You hand your original over at the window, but you do not get a new one back. What you get back is a hodgepodge of doctor's letters, profiles from your shrink, and maybe a driver's license fitting your new role. But these documents are not universally negotiable. Half the country thinks they are counterfeit. You have given up your citizenship and become a stateless person. More than that, any citizen can demand to see your papers. And if they are not satisfied with the quality of your documents, they may perform citizen's arrest. Deidre's encounter with the baseball bat was an example of this. In much of the country, citizens are encouraged to be vigilant in the defense of the linguistic integrity of the nation. I found adapting to life in the linguistic void to be difficult. I was desperate for a biological basis regarding the process I was embarking upon. I wanted a litmus test. For me, this showed up as an endless envy of the AIS girls. AIS stands for androgen insensitivity syndrome. It's a genetic mutation. Your chromosomes are normal 46XY male. You produce testosterone, but your cells do not respond to it, so you grow up looking like a girl. AIS is often only discovered in puberty when these girls do not begin menstruating. Further testing shows the absence of a uterus and the presence of gonadal tissue in the abdomen. Gonadal tissue, which is busy making testosterone, by the way. But what the AIS girls had that I did not was the support of objective medical science. They were not viewed as crazy or immoral. They are not disowned by their families. They had a sanction. When I told my parents what I was going to do, this is what my mother told me. You will be a half thing, neither man nor woman, hated and despised by everyone. My father said nothing, but drew his hand across his throat, mimicking a knife. I became estranged from my family and did not have contact with them for 8 years. At the time, I was much too fragile, couldn't deal with their anger and fear. I felt very hurt. I regret this withdrawal now, but at the time, my plate was just too full. I thought that an objective medical sanction would have made this all easier. I could have shown my family a nice lab report. Such science, if real, would go a long way towards filling in the linguistic void. I could have shown them something in black and white on a medical letterhead. But no reports existed, and none have yet to be established. It was my path to do this the hard way. I had to walk forward with no agreement or support from family or friends. Looking back, I can see the way of it. I had to toughen up. If I have a piece of advice for anyone going down this road, it is that you have to become tough. You have to do what you need to do, even if not a single person in the world agrees with you. There is a stylized pose of the Buddha that I often think about. It depicts the Buddha in a squatting position with one hand extending an index finger, which is touching the ground, and the Buddha's looking straight at you. It is interpreted as the Buddha saying, "The earth is my witness." Sometimes you have to do what you must, and the earth will be your only friend. I have come through the austerity of the linguistic void to a great degree. My envy of the AIS girls has subsided, as well as my need for a transsexual litmus test. It is ironic, but if such a litmus test were to come along now, I would not take it. You see, I'm starting to like myself. I look in the mirror and I like the person I see. I'm starting to like my clothes. I love having the body I have. My life is starting to feel like it's worth living. What could a litmus test add to that? And the people to whom I would have shown it to have all passed away. They are gone. My remaining regret is that we never got to know each other.
Wow, that was great. Thank you. We've only got about 2 minutes left, so I just want to say thank you so much. Tonight we've had on Kira, who is a friend of Jean. And Jean, do you want to close out the show?
Yeah. You know, what Kara has read for us tonight were four pieces from a book that she has produced. That's just loaded. I mean, it's just loaded. Those just four pieces of I don't know how many. And you can tell from the four pieces that were read tonight, Kara's not necessarily being politically correct, but everything she has to say is coming from a lived experience that just is so obvious in what she has to say and what she's written. I think it's really a good, clean, honest representation. And I'm so proud that she's a friend of mine and that she was willing to honor us with some of her readings tonight.
Yes, thank you so much. You've been listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned next for Calculated Conversations. And I just want to thank you so much, Kira. Jean, thank you for being on the show tonight. Thank you, Nicolette.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, and we'll see you all in 2 weeks.
Stay safe out there.